pretty frustrated this weekend, though.
All right, folks. I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is January 24th, 2023. We do have a quorum present, so first item on the agenda will be approval of the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 19th, 2023? Representative Carroll moves the minutes of January 19th. Any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. First up, we've got Chair Richardson. I will move that House File 55 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Welcome, Chair Richardson. And let's see. We do have an amendment. Do you want to take up the amendment first?
I'm happy to start just to provide a little background and then take up the amendment, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
All right. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 55 would establish a missing and murdered Black women and girls office. At this committee's jurisdiction, the bill is limited to the sections of the bill related to data practices, so I'll keep my comments limited to that scope. Section 1, Subdivision 5 focuses on reports and requires public data, including names, dates of disappearances, and dates of death, to be published annually. Section 1, Subdivision 8 deals with access to data, which allows access to confidential and private corrections, detention, and medical data in order to perform its duties as it relates to cold cases for both missing persons and homicide cases. As resolving cold cases is an important contributor to preventing crime, increasing public safety, and maintaining public trust. We know cases involving Black women and girls stay open 4 times longer than their white peers, and this access will be critical to advancing public safety. So thank you again, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill, and happy to stand for questions and the amendments as well.
All right. First, we'll see, are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill today? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to discussion of the bill. Any questions for Chair Richardson about the bill? And remembering that, and thank you for sticking to the data provisions, as that's why this bill is here. Any discussion, members? All right. Seeing none, then we will move on to the amendment. I understand it is a Representative Scott amendment. Representative Scott, would you like to move your amendment and then tell us about it?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the A2 the author's amendment? And then the A4 is my amendment?
The A2 was adopted in public safety.
It wasn't engrossed until last night, so it accidentally made it into the packet.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was a little confused there. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so I'll speak to the A4, and I did mention I had a brief conversation with the bill's author yesterday on the House floor, but I just feel like even though this person may be missing or no longer with us, maybe they have been murdered, I still feel like their medical records and stuff, they should at least try to reach out to the next of kin. We do that in other areas of law. When someone is a decedent, we don't just automatically give way to their medical records and so forth. So I really felt, out of respect for that person and their family, there might be something in their medical records that could really cause an upset to that family. This would just say that this department would, for both this new commission that you're setting up and the one on missing and indigenous women, this would just require that the office makes an attempt to contact the any remaining next of kin and wait 30 days. If they haven't heard from them, then they can move forward.
All right, Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for bringing the amendment and also for finding me on the House floor yesterday to give me a heads up as well. I really appreciate that. You know, as we're looking at this bill and the work that was done and the task force, one of the things that we know is an unfortunate and heartbreaking unifying factor is the fact that when women and girls are killed, most often it's by family members. And in terms of what some of the data tells us, The United Nations on Drug and Crime and the UN Women, their report show that on average more than 5 women or girls were killed every hour by someone in their own family in 2021. And those are the known cases. And so the true scale of this is estimated to be even higher. The way that the bill is set up, it mirrors the current requirements that are in statute with the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office. And there are other places in statute, including the Maternal Mortality Review Committee, that don't require this additional step. So at this time, members, I would be asking for requesting a no vote on the amendment. But I appreciate the concerns that you have, and happy to continue conversations.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just was curious how this proposed amendment works with the privilege statute. There's a whole statute that describes medical records and mental health records and other records as privileged already. There's been some recent case law on that out of the Minnesota Supreme Court. So I do believe some of those protections already exist in other areas of statute. And so, you know, for that reason, I'll be voting no as well, but just wanted to point that out and say I'm glad to talk to Lead Scott about that as well.
Representative Feist. Oh, sorry. Final word on the amendment,
Madam
Representative
Chair, thank
Scott.
Thank you, and be glad to learn more about what Representative Moeller just mentioned. But, I mean, Representative Richards, you rattled off some UN numbers. Those aren't Minnesota specific. And so if you have any data on what happens here in Minnesota, I don't know. I just find it a respectful thing to do to try to contact a member of the family. And if it's suspected that it was a member of the family that was responsible for the murder, then don't send it to them. Send it to somebody else. So I will go ahead and ask our members to support the amendment. Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll move on to the vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
All right. The amendment is not adopted. With that, not seeing any further discussion to the bill, Representative Richardson, any closing words on the bill?
I would just like to say thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing the bill here, and just also want to be clear for the record that in Minnesota and surrounding states as well, it is in fact family members very often when we're talking about homicide cases. So thank you for the opportunity to hear the bill and ask for your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 55 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Thank you. Richardson. Next up, we've got Representative Edelson. Let's see. I will move that House File 121 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Edelson, I believe it's an author's amendment, the A1. Would you like us to take care of that and then get to the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Edelson, please tell us what the A1 does.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A1 amendment is some technical fixes, but it also goes to clear the appropriation of what would be in 2023, which is $250,000.
All right. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members, and good morning. Whoa, this is an early committee. Sorry. All right. So the competency restoration bill, I think that for the members that were here last year know that it was the last bill that we passed, and I don't know, there's debate about this, the last 3 or 6 minutes. But with that said, Representative Albright and I worked really hard on this with county attorneys, with NAMI, and the list of stakeholders is pages long. What's the problem we have, though, with this, and we're coming to now, is ideally moving this through so that we can hire the executive director, we'll create the board, hire the executive director, and the navigators. But the thing that we need is money. So in 2023, we didn't have an appropriation, which is what the $250,000 will do. The $250,000 will be used for creation of the board so the governor can appoint it, hiring the executive director, and making sure that we can hire the navigators. So that's pretty much the bill.
All right. And I understand you have a couple testifiers, so we'll move on to testimony. Ms. Aberholden, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. Just as a reminder, back in 2019, the legislature actually passed a bill that NAMI had pushed that authorized a task force to look at competency restoration. We wanted to know what resources were in place, what were the trends, do some case reviews, and research what other states were doing. We met for 2 years, issued an interim report and a final report, and then began working on the bill to actually implement the recommendations. And of course, the language passed in the remaining 3, 4, or 5 minutes, depending on who you talk to, of the legislative session. On a high level, it creates a state board of competency restoration. We disconnected commitment from competency so that we could order people to treatment without going through that process. We created forensic navigators to work with people to develop bridge plans, plans that look at housing, insurance, treatment, food benefits, et cetera. And we developed community competency restoration programs, including locked residential facilities. The purpose is to effectively use our resources to move people into treatment and connect them with resources and put an end to the revolving door and connect people who were deemed incompetent but not committed to services. This was a monumental bill, probably one of the most kind of game-changing in the country that was done last session. But as with any large bills, we have to come back with some technical amendments. Again, these amendments have been worked out with all the numerous stakeholders, and certainly urge your support for this morning.
All right, thank you for your testimony. And then we also have Ryan Flynn here to testify. If you could introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
And if we could get you to move a little bit closer to the, there you go. Thank you.
I'll turn the microphone. Good morning.
Perfect.
My name is Ryan Flynn. I'm a prosecutor with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I've been a prosecutor for 12 years now, and I've been both in an urban setting and greater Minnesota setting. This issue is particularly important for all Minnesotans and for prosecutors across the state and law enforcement across the state. And it represents both a comprehensive compromise between multiple stakeholders, and it received bipartisan support last year, and I hope it again receives your bipartisan support this year. I do want to note that there's an ongoing group of stakeholders who review all this language, including these technical changes, which simply help clarify the language, but also make sure that we preserve that compromise that was reached between so many stakeholders last year. So I hope that this is not a controversial amendment nor bill, particularly this morning, and we ask for your support.
All right. Thank you. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing anyone, we'll move on to member discussion. Members, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just was curious about the comprehensive change of the word restoration to attainment in the language, and was curious about if someone could speak to that change.
I'll just remind everyone, some of us were here at the end of last session, but several of our members were not. So whoever wants to take that question.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's in some ways it's just trying to kind of reframe it that for some folks, maybe we're not really restoring, we're helping them get there in the first place. And so it's just a broader term.
Right, any follow-up, Representative Niska?
Thank you.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Edelson. I'm looking on this bill on 15.11 and 15.12. I agree. I believe this in the long run is going to be a good program. But on the administration of medications, I'm just wondering, because right now it requires a Jarvis ruling and the person has to be institutionalized in order to force medication. I think that was a court ruling that did that. So how are we going to be able to do this when, conditions and factors weigh in favor involuntary administration of the medications?
I'm guessing Mr. Flynn wants to take that one.
Sure. So just to be clear, the administration medication in this bill has all the procedural protections that a Jarvis would. And currently, you would have to be civilly committed in order to be even eligible to be the topic of a Jarvis order. So what this bill does is it allows for the criminal court to also receive a Jarvis petition, but the medical review, the necessity of doctors, the way that it would be implemented, all those medical and sort of due process protections that exist in the civil commitment have essentially been copied and pasted and placed in here as well. So all the due process requirements of hearings of multiple medical personnel agreeing that of its necessity, of reviewing the ability for voluntariness, all of that exists in this system as well.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Mr. Flynn, I like the idea, but I just have concerns it's gonna hold, not going to hold up in court because the person is not institutionalized.
All right. Any further member discussion to the bill? All right. Not seeing any. Any closing words, Representative Adelson?
None. I ask for your support.
And we get up this early all the time.
My first committee's at 10:30. I'm like, ooh.
Must be nice. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 121 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Representative Adelson, some of us had
All right, moving on to House File 91. Welcome to the committee, Representative Liebling. No longer a member of my committee, but welcome back.
Madam Chair, it's hard not to vote.
So I will move that House File 91 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. Representative Liebling, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for getting up all the time at this hour. And so House File 91 is essentially a repealer bill. So we all know that Roe v. Wade was recently overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. And in Minnesota, so we had the right to privacy, the right to have an abortion was protected under Roe for almost 50 years. In Minnesota, we've been fortunate to have the same rights recognized under our Minnesota Constitution in a case called Doe v. Gomez, which was decided in 1995. But we've had other decisions as well. In 1976, we had a decision, Hodgson v. Lawson, then Doe v. Gomez in 95, and then recently in 2022, another case, Doe v. Minnesota, which overturned many of the laws on the books as unconstitutional. So what House File 91 does is it is removing from the statute books many outdated, unused, and unconstitutional laws that infringe on the right to have an abortion in one way or another. So I'm not saying that everything that we're repealing here has been found unconstitutional, but many of them have. So the problem here is that even under Roe, for many, many years, anti-abortion politicians have worked to restrict access to abortion and have put many of these laws into place. For years, they've used shaming, inflammatory rhetoric to convince Minnesotans that politicians should be managing abortion access instead of the people most closely affected, those carrying the pregnancy and their medical professionals. And this constant attack on Minnesotans' right to access abortion is evident throughout our statutes. The problem is that having this patchwork of confusing laws still on the books, some of them unconstitutional, some of them just unused, some of them which, frankly, shouldn't be used, makes it difficult for Minnesotans and healthcare providers to actually know what the law is. It creates a climate of fear. And that's why having some laws on the books that actually don't relate to the way healthcare is provided are bad. They need to go because they create a climate of fear. And they confuse Minnesotans, both those actually using the laws and those who are simply interested in what goes on. These laws chill access to abortion. And in fact, that's probably what some politicians really wanted when they put these laws into place. Doctors want to practice medicine. They don't want to be investigated, sued, or prosecuted. And when these worries hang over their heads, they tend to practice defensively. And we're seeing this really throughout our nation as people with problem pregnancies are unable to access care because doctors are worried that somebody's going to accuse them of doing an illegal abortion or even investigate them. And we see this actually in other areas where we put burdens on physicians and we hang different kinds of requirements over their heads. So it is clear that abortion is health care. It is safer than many other procedures, including giving birth, and there's no need for extra protections or extra reporting. So I should probably mention specifically that in this bill, we are repealing the reporting requirements for abortion. The penalties have been found unconstitutional, not the actual reporting requirements, but we feel that it is important to repeal these requirements because they've been in place 25 years, and they are a burden, and they intrude on the privacy of a person who is having an abortion. They force the physician to go through a bunch of questions, to submit a bunch of data. And I know there are people who think it's great to have that information. They like to see it. We don't do this with any other kind of healthcare procedure. We do not require people to answer questions about why they want it, how they're paying for it, exactly how the procedure is being done, and then reporting all of this to the state. So the bill is here to clean up our statutes, make the law clearer for everyone. And I would say, too, and perhaps I should have started with this, we often talk about freedom in this legislature. We talk about it all the time. And I think freedom includes individual liberty. If we have the government in our bedrooms and our doctor's offices or our hospitals injecting the views of politicians into the most deeply personal decisions that Minnesotans make, we're not really free. So that's why House File 91 is here, and I ask for your support.
All right. Thank you. And we do have quite a few people signed up to testify. I will folks were told when they signed up to testify they have 90 seconds. It is actually out of respect for everybody that we limit that. It's the same amount of time for everyone, but as a reminder today. So I will call the person, if the person on deck could go ahead and come up to the table as well, that will move things along faster as well. So first up, I have Munira Mohammed, and then I have Kathy Blazer on deck.
Hello, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. My name is Munira Mohammed, and I'm the policy associate for the ACLU of Minnesota. That's the American Civil Liberties Union. We see this as an urgent civil liberties issue dealing with bodily autonomy and reproductive freedoms. In prior committees, we've spoken on the need for the PRO Act and passing that. And while that bill is adequate and a significant win, we see the legislature and the need to take steps to remove even more unnecessary restrictions in state law. Repealing obstructive requirements and criminalizing penalties would greatly help Minnesotans look for reproductive care, specifically repealing things such as parental notification for those seeking an abortion, prohibitions on being performed by non-physicians, and restrictions to hospital after the first trimester, mandatory reporting to the Commissioner of Health, any subsequent felonies that come with not reporting, and requiring informed consent and 24-hour waiting periods. These repeals ensure that people across the state can meaningfully exercise their right to reproductive health. The ACLU of Minnesota is in support of House File 91 and is grateful to the committee for hearing it. Thank you to the chair and members.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Kathy Blazer, and then I have Rachel Dick on deck. Please introduce yourself for the committee and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I am Kathy Blazer, co-executive director of MCCL. Minnesota has had abortion reporting requirements since 1998. These were not found unconstitutional by the court case this past summer. This bill is not simply cleaning up statutes. It is actively repealing current enforced law that was specifically not ruled unconstitutional. This is not private information on private individuals, but aggregate information on what the abortion industry wants to call health care. Because we pay for public assistance abortions, it seems fitting we know how many we are paying for and what percentage of our annual budget this represents. It also seems fitting we should know the number and severity of abortion complications, as these likely increase taxpayer expense. Removing the requirement to report complications jeopardizes the health of women and impedes access to statewide data that might help reduce and avoid these complications. Chemical abortions present additional reasons to report complications. Britain and Sweden both recently changed their medical standards for chemical abortions simply to protect the woman's health from very high complication rates. A Finnish study showed 20% of women receiving chemical abortions suffered complications, four times the surgical complication rate. The abortion report confirms that it does sometimes happen that a baby is born alive during an abortion. Removing the requirement to report what care was given to these born alive babies allows abortionists to set aside these living, breathing, helpless patients to simply die with nobody the wiser. Minnesotans have the right to know that how their tax dollars are being used, and the abortion reporting requirements provide this transparency, something abortionists do not want, but taxpayers do. I urge you to vote against this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Rachel Dick, and then I have Elena Niehoff on deck. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning to the chairs and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Dick, and I am a graduate student in the neuroscience PhD program at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 91. Today's hearing focuses on something that I know very well as a scientist, data. When I'm in the lab, the types of data that I collect depend on the goals and the scientific questions that I'm asking. I gather information because I want to learn about what causes schizophrenia and how we might treat it. It is clear that the goal of Minnesota Statute 2022, specifically Section 145.4131, which is part of what's being discussed today, is to surveil women and the choices that we make, which is incredibly frightening. We don't report this type of invasive information to the state on colonoscopies or tonsillectomies, both of which are more dangerous than abortion. It's unclear what the scientific question here is, besides being able to weaponize misleading statistics about born alive infants to score political points. These data being collected under our current laws are both pointless and dangerous, and this statute must be repealed. HF 91 is an essential bill that will restore the dignity and reproductive autonomy of all birthing people. I urge you to advance it without amendment. To all the legislators who are here today and prepared to vote yes, I want to thank you. I know that this work is hard and some of these votes are politically costly. We, the pro-choice majority of Minnesota voters, have your backs. Thank you for keeping us safe.
Thank you for your testimony. Mrs. Elena Niehoff, and then I have Deborah Zavasic on deck. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and the committee members, my name is Elena Niehoff. I'm a registered nurse from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm testifying in objection to the bill HF 91. The bill HF 91 is a disaster for Minnesota families because it violates the parental rights. Parental rights are inalienable rights given by God. The Nuremberg Code and Helsinki Declaration states that a man and a woman are the primary decision maker in regard of any medical procedure, not the government. In the case of a minor, a parent or a guardian are the primary decision makers. There is a reason why the minor in the United States cannot drive until they are 16, and they cannot drink until they are 21. These laws have been established for the minors because of the level of their maturity and mental capacity. But according to the authors of the bill, HF 91, children can comprehend the consequences of the abortion procedure and the side effects of the abortion drugs. I believe this is a malpractice. The Nuremberg Code, I quote, "Directives for human experimentation, the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. This means that the person involved should have the legal capacity to give consent. The child cannot give consent.
Thank you for your testimony. Deborah Zavasek and then Ray Parker on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Deborah Zavasek. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Please support HF 91. My dear friend got devastating news of an untreatable condition at week 16 of a much-wanted pregnancy, preventing fetal bone formation. The fetus might survive, but at birth she would lack a functional rib cage. Her lungs couldn't expand and contract, so she would suffocate and die. Agonized by the thought of this suffering, my friend opted for an abortion. Her California doctors explicitly assured her that the anesthesia dose would keep the fetus from feeling pain. They provided high-quality, compassionate care without fear of civil action, not because they're required to by law, but because they practice ethical, sound medicine. Her California doctor wasn't required to ask personal questions like, why are you getting this abortion, and report her answers like here in Minnesota. Her doctor wasn't required to make completely false statements like, abortion may increase your risk of breast cancer, like here in Minnesota. I do medical research and my husband's an ER doc. I strive to publish the best and most ethical research that I can, and my husband and clinical colleagues strive to provide the best and most ethical medical care that they can, and Minnesota abortion providers do the same. Abortion is reproductive health care. HF 91 is needed to repeal laws that single out abortion, stigmatize it, and restrict it in ways not applied to other kinds of health care. Standards of care, codes of practice, medical boards, and personal ethics ensure high-quality, ethical medical care for Minnesotans. Abortion care should be treated no differently. Please support HF 91, and thank you so much for your time and service. And thank you, Representative Liebling. There are some more examples on my written testimony.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Ray Parker and Sherry Kempf on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, my name is Ray Parker. I'm here to address the lack of care of the born alive infant portion of this HF 91 bill. To be clear, I am not speaking about those infants who have such egregious defects as to make life outside the womb impossible. I am speaking on behalf of those individuals who are born alive and fully capable of living and growing into a productive, loving individual. Statistics show that 1 in 4 women have had an abortion, that only around 1.5% of abortions are due to rape and incest. I have not seen any statistics on trafficking victims, none of which is addressed on how to protect them. And although the numbers of infants who are born alive are statistically low, just as in the case of rape and incest, why aren't you as concerned about those infants? Could it be that it isn't about rights, but a concern about power, that you get to decide who lives and who dies? Or maybe it's about the money, trafficking of body parts, organs, and tissues of the infant, who even if he or she lives through the attempted abortion, can be killed through neglect and then sold off to the highest bidder? And are you so demonically influenced that you won't stand for any infant that beats the odds and lives through the abortion? Are you so demonically driven that you see it necessary to steal the chance of life for that infant and deem the infant to be worthless and given no rights? After all, you are taking away the safeguards that protects those infants struggling to remain alive. Please vote no to HF 91.
Thank you for your testimony. Sherry Kempf and then Renee Carlson on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hello. My name is Sherry Kempf. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I urge you to support HF 91, which will increase equity for all Minnesota women. According to research done by the Guttmacher Institute, low-income women and women of color are more likely to experience unintended pregnancy and abortion, and women of color are more likely to be low income. Amending statutes governing medical assistance in Minnesota care coverage of abortion services will remove barriers that disproportionately affect low-income women and women of color. Another step toward achieving equity is repealing the requirement for parental notification of or judicial approval for minors. Again, research shows that the overwhelming majority of pregnant teenage women confide in at least one parent, However, those that do not have very real reasons for not doing so. They may be kicked out of their homes, physically abused, or disowned by their families. As a former teacher, I have unfortunately seen this happen. Requiring parental notification or judicial approval can lead to additional threats to teenage women's health, such as late-term or illegal abortions, or continuing a pregnancy in secret without receiving adequate prenatal care for mother or baby. I believe that Minnesota values equity for all women, regardless of race, income, or age. Passing HF 91 is one step toward achieving this equity. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Renee Carlson, and I have Christy Hall on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Renee Carlson. I serve as general counselor for True North Legal. HF 91 repeals many laws, including all abortion reporting requirements, eliminating accountability for the abortion industry, inconsistent with health and safety standards throughout the country and even throughout the world. Only three states in the U.S. do not voluntarily submit abortion reporting to the CDC. Even the most progressive abortion regimes in the country, like the District of Columbia and New York City, provide voluntary reporting reports. Even in Canada, where a person has no legal rights in the country until they are born, accurate abortion numbers are reported nationwide. Medical professionals and policymakers desiring to reduce abortion-related complications for women need to know the critical information in these reports. If HF1 passes, abortion reporting will be even more imperative, since late-term abortions create increased risks for women and have a higher correlation of failed abortions. It is doubtful that this repeal is based on medical privacy, when further discussion about implementing legal safeguards to protect individual medical privacy and reporting has been bypassed. Though the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of statutes, including mandatory reporting provisions with considerable privacy protections. If HF 91 passes, Minnesota law will surpass states and countries with some of the most extreme abortion laws in the world. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. Christy Hall, and then I have Maggie Hongi on deck. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christy Hall, and I'm the senior staff attorney at Gender Justice. I'm here today to urge support of HF 91. In 2019, Gender Justice filed a lawsuit on behalf of two healthcare providers, the First Unitarian Society of Minneapolis and Our Justice, Minnesota's abortion fund, challenging abortion restrictions in the state. Last July, only 2 weeks after the fall of Roe v. Wade, a judge determined those restrictions were unconstitutional and permanently blocked their enforcement. Passing HF 91 would get these laws off our books for good. Leaving unconstitutional statutes on the books creates dangerous legal ambiguity for providers and patients in our state. We only have to look to North Dakota and Wisconsin, where all abortion care has ceased, to see the effects of old laws coming back. And I wanted to specifically talk about two of the laws that would be repealed, the two-parent notification requirement for minors seeking abortion. Until it was struck down as unconstitutional last year, the parental notification law in Minnesota was one of the most extreme in the country. It required minors seeking abortion care to notify both parents, even if they had no relationship with their parents, or their relationships were abusive. They could show up with one parent with them and still be forced to go through the court system to plead for an exemption. That's no way to treat Minnesota's youth. Minnesota law rightly already entrusts young people to make decisions about their bodies when it comes to things like STIs, et cetera. I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Maggie, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure how to pronounce your name, so why don't you tell us and introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, thank you. Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee, my name is Maggie Hange, and I'm the policy associate at the Minnesota Catholic Conference. I'm here today to share opposition to HF 91 and specifically to repealing the abortion reporting requirements. Removing the reporting requirement is an unnecessary and reckless decision. These reports share valuable data from which all Minnesotans benefit. For example, the 2021 abortion report reveals that nearly 13% of abortions were procured for economic reasons. We can also see from comparing various MDH reports that nearly 25% of black pregnancies end in abortion compared to only 9% of white pregnancies. With that knowledge, we can address the economic and racial disparities for pregnant Minnesotans. Perhaps the expectant mother needed assistance purchasing a car seat, did not have adequate housing or enough money to properly nourish her child. Because of the report, we can now enact or strengthen programs to truly walk with mothers in need and help them secure the proper resources to bring their child into this world. Repealing the abortion reporting requirement will also be detrimental to women who seek an abortion, since without that in place, there will be no accountability for the abortion provider, not to mention that our tax dollars are paying for many of these abortions. Minnesotans deserve to know where and how these tax dollars are being used and if the state is being good stewards of our money. It is common practice anywhere we go to fill out paperwork and share the reason for our visit. Thus, nearly every facet of our government and day-to-day lives gets reported. Removing the abortion reporting requirement is not a service to Minnesota women. Instead, it is a way for abortion providers to keep their unethical practices in the dark. We hope you vote no on HF 91. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sarah Longacre, and then I've got Professor Collette on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, members of the committee and Madam Chair. My name is Sarah Longacre, Minneapolis native, 47-year-old, and a birth doula for 22 years. Most importantly, I am a mother. I'm a mother to a 16-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 9-year-old, and my daughter, Sophia Love, who would have been 6 years old this past November. At a 20-week ultrasound on June 21st, 2017, very routine until we found out that my daughter, Sophia Love, had no chance of living outside of my womb. There was water all over her head and her heart and her brain. I was given no choice, but actually I was given many choices. I was given choices in the paperwork that constantly asked me, think about your decision and consider all of your choices. I then had to go home to be with my other three children, trying to explain to them at that time when they were 7, 5, and 2 years old what had happened to their daughter and that she was still inside of me, but she wouldn't be within the next few days. These are not choices. These are shaming comments that I had to sign paperwork. I felt shame like I have never, ever had before. I went home after giving birth to my daughter, still with shame and so many questions. I also had to wait an extra 2 days due to the fact that I found this information out on a Thursday, having to wait 24 hours, and a doctor would not be available. So for 3 full days, I had to go around with my unborn child and all of the feelings and emotions. I hope that you really consider who this affects. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. Professor Collette, and then I have Dr. Chasen on deck. Please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Teresa Collette. I'm here in my private capacity, although I direct the Pro-Life Center at the University of St. Thomas. In addition, I have an active practice that includes representation of mothers offering maternal support or moms who are currently seeking to intervene in the Doe v. Minnesota case. In my written testimony submitted and available in your packets, you will find a copy of the docket of Doe v. Minnesota. The first 5 pages reflect the fact that the case is still open and that there is not only our motion to intervene under consideration by the trial court in order to try the case properly, given that the Attorney General presented no evidence, and that is the phrase that the trial court uses multiple times in its opinion, no evidence relating such basic facts as minors' ability to make decisions is not comparable to adults, the value of parental involvement, and a number of other facts. In fact, the Attorney General presented only two expert reports that didn't address most of the major issues, as the trial court repeatedly stated in its original opinion. This case is open and has not been concluded, and the representation that these laws have been struck down is simply
false, and certainly incomplete. There is also an appeal pending before the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which the plaintiffs sought to have dismissed, which the Court of Appeals declined to dismiss. In other words, there is no final determination about the constitutionality of these statutes, and give a fair trial, they will be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Chasen, and then I have John Robinson on deck. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nicole Chasen, a practicing family physician in Minneapolis and an associate medical director at Planned Parenthood North Central States. I'm proud to provide a broad spectrum of essential health care, including abortion, to patients across the lifespan. Repeal of the state's restrictive laws has lifted a huge burden for many people seeking abortion, but particularly for the youth that I work with. As a trusted adult in their lives, I've had teens seek advice when they find out they're pregnant. Some come with a parent. Others want help telling their parent. Others are estranged from their family and just need medical care and advice. Some have continued their pregnancy and some have not. What I can attest to is they seek information from trusted sources, including their healthcare provider, and we should be able to help them without adding barriers to care. Until last summer, many teens in Minnesota were stuck navigating the complexity of the judicial bypass system, further delaying their ability to access safe, timely health care. That was followed by state-mandated consent and a 24-hour waiting period that was not patient-centered or evidence-based. And finally, in the clinic, further invasive questioning was required so our clinic would comply with the mandated data collection for the state. This information was not relevant to their health or their abortion. Rather, it was meant to monitor them and their decisions. In healthcare, we're trained to assess capacity for all sorts of medical decisions. It's something I do every day in every clinical encounter, and it's true for adults, not just for teens. I've always been trusted in my ability to determine if a young person is able to decide to continue a pregnancy, and I should be able to determine if they are able to decide to end a pregnancy. To support all patients, we must remove these restrictive abortion laws that have been found unconstitutional, and if we don't, they may remain a potential threat. Please support House File 91. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. John Robinson.
My name is John Robinson. I'm a resident of Rochester, Minnesota. And I specifically have been looking at both the PRO bill, the issue that went before the Minnesota Supreme Court, as well as this particular piece of legislation. And I find multiple things very, very concerning. One of the things that I've specifically seen, I do a lot of research and reading specifically in bioethics because my wife works in bioethics. And one of the things that I have specifically seen over and over and over and over again is that you need to define a standard of care. Because when you're talking about a certain series of procedures, that standard of care determines the risk factors that are involved in whatever you're engaging in. There was a statement within PRO, and the reason that I'm bringing up PRO is that PRO, to a certain degree, is being seen as taking over. And the litigation that we have that was talked about previously with regard to the Minnesota State's Supreme Court's decision, among other things, brings to question kind of what are we looking at? Are we looking at additional legal entailment? There are additional parts of this that we haven't talked about in this bill, a significant number of them, which have jurisprudence decisions already on the books, which could be very troublesome. And so I just wanted to first say standard of care, let's open up standard of care. Let's take a look at other situations that are real that I do not want to see here in the state of Minnesota. I do not think most abortion providers want to see here in the state of Minnesota. I don't know why Planned Parenthood will want to see here in the state of Minnesota. There's an expectation and there's a constitutional need for the legislature to protect the health of Minnesotans. And so to not talk about things in the
Mr. Robertson, I'll have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. The specific issue is the Grosnell case, Kermit Grosnell, There are a series of issues that came up with this case where he was found guilty of third-degree murder.
Mr. Robinson, that doesn't sound like wrapping up, and out of respect to everybody else, if you do have written materials, we'd be happy to distribute them to the committee for folks to...
I have sent them to Ann, but they seem to have disappeared. I sent a letter to...
There's a packet of letters that we have from many people that's in the packets. If we don't have it there, we can certainly make sure that the committee members do get it.
All right. I will make sure that they have access one way or another.
Okay. Thank you so much. With that, members, we don't have anyone else signed up to testify. So we do have an amendment. I understand it's a Representative Scott amendment. Representative Scott, would you like to move your amendment and tell us what it does?
Madam Chair, thank you. Before I do that, would it be possible for you to ask if there are any members of the public that wish to testify?
Oh, yeah.
I'm gonna leave anybody out that came up early this morning to be here.
Yeah, sure. Anyone come up this morning who would wish to testify who didn't sign up?
Madam Chair, one of my colleagues sent a letter. She was not able. She had a...
Okay, well, yep, we... Yep. Yep, there are many letters in your packets from many people on both sides of the issue. We are happy to send out additional letters. We all have public email addresses and phone numbers. I've been hearing from many folks across the state. Sorry that I missed that. It was not intentional. If you'd like to go ahead about your amendment, please go ahead, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for asking for members of the public to come forward. Thank you to everybody that testified this morning. What my amendment does is it reinstates the reporting requirements. In the decision, the district court decision this year, this summer, regarding the reporting requirements, it was found that they weren't unconstitutional, that they posed no obstacles for anyone seeking an abortion to hurdle over. And I have the decision here in front of me that speaks to that. And I just wanted to read a couple of the sentences from the decision. Regarding privacy, plaintiff's privacy claim related to the reporting law survives only if the law infringes on the fundamental right to access abortion. This court concludes there is no infringement on this right. Further reading, the reporting laws mandate the following reports by physicians and abortion facilities made to the health commissioner: the death of a person within a specific time frame following an abortion, various data regarding abortions decided in a calendar year, complications arising from abortion, the number of females who received informed consent regarding abortion under the law, and monthly reports of various abortion patient data. There was a testifier before the courts that found that it takes the staff 5 minutes or less to complete the reporting requirements. And Representative Liebling, the author of the bill, you stated the Hodgson decision earlier, and they also addressed that and found that the record keeping in that case, if not abused or overdone, can be useful to the state's interest in protecting the health of its female citizens and may be a resource that is relevant to decisions involving medical experience and judgments. The judicial task in addressing plaintiff's contention that the reporting laws violate a right to privacy is to determine whether those laws infringe on a pregnant woman's access to abortion care as a matter of law. This court concludes that they do not. Further reading. It is difficult to see how the collection of reporting or such post-abortion care information could be considered invasive, medically irrelevant, or how it would otherwise affect access to abortion. And so, Madam Chair, I would offer my amendment and ask Representative Liebling if she would want to comment on this court's decision that I just read.
Right, and I will clarify that Representative Scott moves the A8-1 amendment. Representative Liebling in response.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. So the first thing I would say is I really find it ironic that you're quoting from the that opinion, Doe versus Minnesota, to say that we should keep some of these laws when obviously the opponents think that this was a completely biased opinion and that the Attorney General didn't really defend the state and so on. And here you are telling us that, in fact, the judge didn't find some things to meet the constitutional threshold to be found unconstitutional. I never have represented that all of the statutes being repealed here have been found to violate the Constitution. Clearly, those are high standards. Courts don't like to overturn laws that legislatures have passed and governors have signed. They don't. And so what I would say to you is I'm not trying to repeal it. We're not trying to repeal it because a court found it unconstitutional in this case. Many of the laws in this bill are, in fact, unconstitutional, have been found unconstitutional. This is not one of them. What I would say, since we're on the topic of the reporting, one of the testifiers talked about how the reports drive change. And I would just say that they've been there for 25 years. Whatever change was going to be driven by these reports probably already would have happened. This is a policy decision, not a decision about what a court has done in this case with the reporting. So whether a court finds that it rises to the level of violating the constitutional right to privacy, or whether members of the legislature just understand that this intrudes on a person's right to get an abortion in a way that we, the legislature, find unacceptable, and whether it intrudes on the medical profession and implies that they need to be micromanaged in this one particular area, whether a court agrees with that or not, we, the legislature, have the ability to make that judgment, and that's what I am putting forward in this bill. I'm not saying that a court found it unconstitutional, and the judge is applying a particular standard, and that's not the standard that we need to apply here in the legislature.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I continue, I'd like to ask for a roll call on this amendment. And on the bill. Representative Liebling, we just passed a bill in this committee that is going to look at a person's medical records and report on it. We also passed a bill earlier that has to do with the mortality of mothers, and they're going to do record keeping on that. So it is not uncommon to collect data to inform decisions on healthcare in this state moving forward. It is not uncommon. Contrary to what you're saying, we keep all kinds of data on these things. Most of it is de-identified, as is in this case. But data informs the public policy, which is what we're doing here. And earlier you said that these sorts of decisions shouldn't be determined by politicians, but you just said that politicians, we here around this table, have the ability to change policy. So I'm thinking you kind of want it both ways, and you were talking about earlier a climate of fear. A climate of fear for whom? We are talking about a bill that repeals medical treatment to an infant born that survives an abortion, left on a cold, sterile, stainless steel table, if you can envision this in your mind, a helpless human being that cannot survive on its own, the most vulnerable among us. Where is the humanity? Last night in Ways and Means, we were talking about House File 4. The driver's licenses for illegals. And Representative Hassan was very adamant
Representative Scott,
about the humanity.
Representative Scott.
About the humanity of Representative, these people that chose
Representative
to come
Scott.
To this country.
Representative Scott, I was just going to correct you that we do not refer to people as illegals. No human is illegal.
Where's the law saying that? So we had a bill talking about the humanity of people that come to this country knowingly, adults coming to this country knowingly breaking the law. And I understand reasons for coming here. And she was talking about the humanity. Where's the humanity here? When is a human being, when is a baby a human, Representative Liebling? When is a baby considered a human? We have laws on the books. If you're in a car accident and the mother and a pregnant mom is killed, that person and both the baby and the mom, that person is charged with the murder of two people or vehicular homicide. When is a baby a human? Representative Liebling.
Representative Scott, I'm not sure. Are you asking an actual question?
I am, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Liebling. And then we've got a couple other people on your side of the table, Representative Scott, who would like to weigh in. Representative Liebling.
Right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And there are a number of things to respond to there. And, you know, first of all, I think the inflammatory rhetoric that is used in this space, I understand we all have feelings about abortion, Representative Scott, everyone does. And these questions about when is a baby a human, when does human life begin, you know, the thing is, different people have different feelings about those issues. And their feelings may change depending on their own personal situation. So we had a testifier up here, a woman who was talking about having to have an abortion because of something that happened to her fetus. So in that situation, it doesn't matter what I think is human or not human or, you know, it matters what she thinks. It matters what her family thinks. That's what matters. And so that's why your question to me is completely irrelevant. Why should I, as a politician, inflict my feeling about it into somebody else's life? That would be absolutely wrong. And I think most Minnesotans would think that was absolutely wrong. But to go back to, I think I need to answer something else that you were talking about. This inflammatory rhetoric around, you know, that somebody is going to fail to give medical care to an infant. You know, we've been collecting data on this. We've been collecting it 25 years. And this so-called Born Alive Infant Act, I was here when it passed, and there's information collected on that. And I went back and looked at every report. I think it's 2015, maybe 2016. The reports are all there. And there is not one suggestion in there that any such thing would have happened. And in fact, you know, all kinds of allegations that are made, they're just not consistent with the data. There has been data. So, you know, the data, whatever the use the data is, people sure aren't using it. They're making the same inflammatory allegations that they always made regardless of the data. So I'll stop talking, Madam Chair, and let some other people respond. Oh, I do want to say one other thing, Representative Scott, about this. No, there is some irony here. You and I are often on the same side of these privacy discussions because I know you are really protective of people's privacy, especially their medical privacy, and we often team up on those issues. And it's really ironic that in this case that you're just happy to keep on collecting all kinds of data to force physicians to ask people in these most intimate, fraught situations to provide all this information. When in other areas, sure, we do collect it in other areas. For some stuff, we collect limited information, and you and I usually team up to say we should not. So there's a real irony here around that, Representative Scott.
And before we move on to member discussion, I'll remind everybody in the room that Mason still applies in our committees, so we are not going to bring up motives on either side. So just a reminder to everyone and a reminder that you do have to defer to me as the chair. That is my privilege as the chair of the committee. That is how this whole system works. If we don't do that, then this whole committee system does not work. So I have given us lots of time. We'll have time. Everybody on your side of the aisle, everyone will get a chance to weigh in if they choose to. Would you like to go ahead, or can we go on to
I need to respond to a couple of things. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott, remembering that Representative Niska and Representative Johnson would also like to speak as well.
And I'll just address the last point that was brought up.
because you're right, Representative Liebling, we usually do agree on a lot of this stuff. This is de-identified data. This is a statistic that we're collecting here. I don't oppose collecting statistics. No one's looking into these people's medical records and making them public in any way. In fact, that's statute's very explicit on that. It highly protects the personal information of someone that's had an abortion, as well it should. So I just want to clear that up. Madam Chair, I'll let you go ahead with other.
Yep, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today marks as a new member, the beginning of my fourth week in the legislature, and I just need to comment on how disorienting and confusing this debate is compared to everything else that I've been experiencing in the legislature. We hear a lot about equity. We hear a lot about our privilege. We hear a lot about oppression. I hope we're all here seeking justice and trying to root out oppression, but it's very disorienting and confusing to see the majority party and the bill author here show no concern at all for the weakest and most voiceless.
Representative Niska, just a reminder of what I just said about motives. We're not going to speak to why anybody is doing what they are doing. We're going to speak to the language in front of us and whether it's a good idea or a bad idea.
Absolutely.
Representative Niska.
And the amendment itself attempts to show concern for the most voiceless, the most threatened human beings in the state of Minnesota. And the bill author said that the data reporting has shown that this isn't happening. I believe she meant to refer to only to Minnesota, because it certainly happens in other places. And if it's not happening in Minnesota, maybe that's a reason why our data reporting is important. So that's very disorienting and confusing. It's also very disorienting and confusing to me why one type of business gets all of the regulations on it repealed because of, in the words of the bill author, a climate of fear or the burdens or the requirements that were hanging over their heads. We have reporting requirements in all kinds of different businesses. Representative Scott mentioned some. I was just reading yesterday a bill that I think is coming before this committee soon about warehouse distribution centers and the data that they have to collect and provide to employees about their performance, that the employees are entitled to get that data. Over and over again, on almost every one of my committees, we're talking about how the state is going to intervene, not just trust businesses to do the right thing, but intervene and regulate those businesses and those private transactions. It's very difficult to understand the logic of why one industry is given the highest level of deference and, frankly, a level of extreme libertarian, pro-business libertarian position that I don't think any Republican would even support with regard to any business that Republicans would want to favor. So this is very sensible amendment to this bill. It's even with this amendment, it's not a good bill. So I'd urge members to vote yes on the amendment.
All right, and members, I'm just going to slow us down a bit because there's been a lot of talking over me, and that just isn't going to play. So part of the deal is we're going to talk through the chair. We're not going to speak over me. Okay? All right, Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Liebling, I'm very disappointed in this bill and very disappointed that you will not accept Representative Scott's amendment. This is not, the data that's collected is aggregate. It doesn't specify who's who, but it's important data so we know what's going on. So we know that the number of African Americans having abortions is much higher than Caucasian. We know that because we have the data. And with that data, we can start looking at and finding out why. So we can end them. But without the data, it's hard to do that. And that's what is so important about this data and the reporting. Well, there's some other things that I'll that take in this bill that I'll talk about later. But this is an important amendment because we need that data so we can get information. Like I said, about the who's getting these abortions. We have in Minnesota, we have a issue where we get love to hand out money to people. And those that are downtrodden and have trouble, I have no problem helping them. But it needs to be a hand up and not a handout. We spent many years giving money and funds to certain communities, keeping without giving them a hand up. It's just keeping them down under our thumbs. We need to change how we do these policies and our programs so we can end the fact that 25% of African Americans have abortions. And thankfully that number I believe is down because it used to be higher. Because the person who he originally did Planned Parenthood and got it started, their goal was to eradicate the black race. And I don't want to do that because they're a great person. But I hope we will put on this amendment. House File 1 is extreme enough, and this one is even more extreme. So it'll make it a little better, but still a bad bill.
And Representative Grosso, was this to the amendment, or did you want to speak to the bill?
To the bill, yeah.
Okay, thank
Madam
you.
Chair, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to address a couple things that have been said about this amendment, including one of the testifiers said, you know, when we go to the doctor, we're expected to fill out all kinds of information. And that really struck me as odd because doctors ask information that they need to perform to care about our health and to perform whatever procedure we might be there for. Looking at this amendment and including the specific reason for the abortion, I don't think doctors need to know that information in order to provide health care. You know, there was a testifier that submitted a letter that says a surgeon asks, are you getting these breast implants because you're a breast cancer survivor, or are they purely cosmetic? We don't need to collect this information. Our providers don't need to have that information, and then certainly not to be providing that to the government when we fill out information when we go to the doctor about why we're there for care. Even if it is not identified, we don't need that information. The government doesn't need to have that information. So I'm going to be voting no on this amendment. Thank you.
I'm going to move on to the vote on the amendment. Any closing comments on your amendment, Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mueller, I understand what you're saying. So I would accept a friendly amendment right now to take that one piece out, if that would mean you support the rest of the bill for the amendment.
Representative Mueller is shaking her head as far as Representative Mueller, any response?
No, there are other pieces of this amendment as well. It's more extensive than just that. So I'll be opposing this amendment. I don't consider that a friendly amendment.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott, and then I do want to have some time to discussion of the bill once we get past the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a small piece of this really vile bill. We, as policymakers, use data all the time, every day, to inform our decisions. We need to keep collecting this data to inform decisions, and quite frankly, for the health of moms, in many cases, when there are complications with abortions, we need to know that. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. Some of this data collection is making sure that these unlicensed facilities are at least we're at least learning if in a very vague way, if those facilities are safe or not. By determining complications, if it's an infection, something like that, that they could have picked up at the abortion facility. So members, this is a very small piece. It's a crumb. Please support it.
All right. A roll call having been requested, Representative Scott renews her motion to adopt the A8-1 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Lead Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weins.
Yes.
All right. With 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. With that, we'll move on to discussion of the underlying bill. Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair and committee members and Representative Liebling, in all my years in law enforcement, doing investigations, violent crimes, etc., I could take about anything. But when you harm a child, that tears my heart out. Anyone who takes advantage of a child or harms a child, there's a special place for them. Now, there are people that need help. There are people that need help in this world. And when you have a young lady that is looking for that help because of an unplanned or a pregnancy that has been as a result of incest or rape, help them. But there are two people there that need that help. That child and a mother. We should be punishing those who have committed those crimes. Not one of the innocent bystanders, not one of the victims. The child had no choice in this. People ask when life begins. Science says that when two cells come together, it's a new life. That's science. That's science, folks. And nowhere in any of our statutes, nowhere in anybody's religion or faith, is the shedding of innocent blood acceptable that I am aware of. Nowhere. There are two people at stake here, a mother and a child. They both need help. They both need us to take care of them. And you say the government should not be forcing their will or sticking their nose where it don't belong. Well, what are you doing here? What are we doing here? You said the thing about using fear and inflammatory rhetoric. You know, how about we take a look at this bill? And Rep. Scott said it best, it is vile. But I'm going to add to that barbaric. It is barbaric, Representative Liebling. With repealing the Born Alive Act, with repealing that and get rid of that, you're essentially taking that child. If they survive the abortion procedure, if they happen to survive that abortion procedure, and it says right in there clear as day that they are to be recognized as a human being if they are born, and in some of our other statute it says if you murder a pregnant woman who's carrying a baby, that's a double homicide. So somewhere in between one statute where we consider that baby a human being or a life, and a person can do prison time for that, taking that life, and we could look at this Born Alive Act to where, no, they got to be born first before we consider them a human being. What have we come to as a state? What have we come to as people?
to where we have these kinds of bills for House File 1. Essentially, you have made it open season on babies in the womb. And now this bill, if that child survives that abortion, and this is my question, is it the intention of the author, is it the intention of this bill that if that child survives that abortion procedure, they're to be no longer considered a human being, they're to be left there to suffer and die alone with nobody rendering aid to them? Is that the intention of this bill?
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm glad you asked me that because it gives me the opportunity to respond to what is one of the most egregious inflammatory allegations that I've heard from the anti-abortion forces. You know, the criminal law in Minnesota still exists, and doctors have ethical rules. And what you have just alleged happens doesn't happen. And if it did, we don't need this special law to have it be not acceptable and possibly criminal. So this is, as I said in another committee, this would be akin to if we had a law on the books that said legislators must not beat their spouses. And then we tried to repeal that law, and then some members would be sitting here saying, oh no, then legislators can legally beat their spouses. It just wouldn't be the case. There are laws, general laws, against beating your spouse. There are laws against homicide. There are ethical rules that doctors have against having a patient who needs care and refusing to give it. So no, this is not a thing. This is a myth. It is a myth. And having this law on the books perpetuates that myth. And it has more in it. That statute had more in it than just the part you're talking about. It required using a hospital and having a second doctor. And it just creates hurdles, and it creates fear, and it demonizes the medical profession by suggesting that they need a special law to stop them from doing horribly unspeakable things. And the reporting that we have has shown that that, in fact, doesn't happen. It's just a myth. So, you know, this is just inflammatory rhetoric that we've heard for years. I've heard this kind of rhetoric for years in this body. It doesn't happen. It isn't happening. And if it did happen, there are other laws to take care of it. We don't need this law. So, thank you.
Great. Follow-up, Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Liebling, for that word salad of a response that answered nothing. You did not answer the question that are you going to leave that child there to suffer and die?
Representative Grossel, we're going to move on to Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grossel.
I was going to refer to this letter as well from a nurse. Who?
Well, Representative Grossel, let's remember that we're colleagues and we're going to speak to each other respectfully.
I am, Madam Chair.
I don't think referring to an answer by one of your colleagues as word salad is, you know what I'm referring to, so just rein it in a little bit, please.
If my questions, Madam Chair.
The questions are fine. It's your tone, Representative Grossel. It's the whole thing. So I will give you back the floor, but I'm just asking you.
Is the truth disturbing, Madam Chair? It should be.
Representative Grossel. You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, the stuff that you say doesn't happen. I've got a letter. We've got a letter here in the file from a nurse who goes through in detail of this very thing happening in the NICU that she worked, where this baby survived the aborted attempt using saline, burned extensively over the body, but the child was still breathing. At 5.5 months, approximately 5.5 months, 5 to 5.5 months. And she was assigned the duty to sit with that child until that child expired, suffering from those burns, from the attempted abortion. Madam Chair, committee, this is no solution. You're not taking into account the other life here. And if I'm not mistaken, the majority of abortions are little girls. The highest percentage. I've got two wonderful daughters and a granddaughter. You're not doing anybody any justice with this.
All right, I've got Representative Johnson and then Representative Scott. We do have another bill on the agenda. I did think it was important to allow folks to fully discuss, but we do have some testifiers that traveled from rural Minnesota to be here. So I'm going to go to Representative Johnson and then Representative Scott, and then we'll move on to the vote. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfitt, Representative Liebling, disappointed where this bill is going. This body's had a standard of when things are in court, we don't touch it. This issue is not done in court yet. The appeals process is still moving forward. I think this bill needs to be set aside until we find out what's going on. Maybe deal with it next year if the courts, once the appellate time has ended. But we have other issues in this bill. You say, even though we have documentation from a witness who actually gave their name, it's not an anonymous, that botched abortions happen and the child is born alive. Now, we don't know if that happens in some of our abortion centers. We don't know if they're documenting everything properly or correctly. Because guess what? We don't even inspect them. We don't even check on them. We don't even check their cleanliness. We don't check to make sure that they don't have things in there that can cause infections. We don't even know if they actually have people qualified to do the abortions because they're not inspected or licensed. So we don't know if they're filing their reports correctly. You also removed the issue dealing with minors and parental notification after going through the courts. Yet in Chapter 146B, dealing with professional standards, 146B.07, subdivision C, and I think it's B, a person under 18 cannot get a tattoo or a piercing without parental consent. The parent has to be there or have written permission in order to get a tattoo or even a body piercing, to piercing their ears. But we can have a 10-year-old or 12-year-old that's a sex slave in sex trafficking. They can bring her in and have an abortion and sterilize them without parental consent. As I said earlier, House File 1 was extreme and crazy. This is even worse. Vote no.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've said before that data informs our decision. I just want to reiterate that that it is a mistake to move this bill forward without having those provisions in there. And I just want to talk a little bit about what this bill does in regard to repealing the infant born alive. That bill was passed on a bipartisan basis. I don't have the exact vote totals here, but
largely Democrats and Republicans supported that bill. And I think that, and I hope, that we could get some bipartisan support on this. And maybe one of the reasons that Representative Liebling is saying that there is this isn't happening is because that bill's in place. Members, please vote no on the bill.
Closing words, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just be really quick. I just did want the committee to understand on the parental rights piece, which was found unconstitutional in Doe v. Minnesota. I want people to understand that under the law, 144.343, that minors are allowed to consent to many things. So minors can give consent for medical, mental, and other health services to determine the presence of or to treat pregnancy and conditions associated therewith, venereal disease, alcohol and other drug abuse, and the consent of no other person is required. So the parental consent to parent consent is in the law as an exception to that general law. And that is what is being repealed so that people can debate whether minors at what age should be allowed to consent to this or that. But the fact is that the law as it is now sets up abortion as a special situation separate from all those other things. And that is why it needs to be repealed. Even though it's been found unconstitutional, it's confusing to leave it on the books. So thank you. I ask members to vote for the bill.
All right. Renew my motion that House File 91 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Lead Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
On a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to public safety. Thank you. Going to move right ahead with House File 420. Thank you for your patience. Did think it was important for a full member discussion on that, so thank you for sticking around for a couple more minutes. Representative Ryer, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 420 be re-referred to the Workforce Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. I understand that you do have two testifiers, and I wanted to make sure that we were able to get in their testimony today since they're able to be here in person. Representative Ryer, please tell us about your bill, and then we'll get to the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm happy to be here with this bill. It's a bill that's close to my heart that in the past has had bipartisan support and brings value to families who are struggling in Minnesota. House File 420 raises the amount for the statewide Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership by $30 from each dissolution filing fee and $30 for each filing fee for licenses that are filed without premarital counseling. Now, I want to note these amounts are increased without raising the overall cost to paid by the applicants. So imagine yourself as a person who for years, maybe decades, has been caring for your family at home, dependent on another person's income. Then picture how you'd feel when that income is suddenly taken away through death, disability, divorce, or other personal loss. Maybe you've never worked outside the home, and suddenly your whole life has changed. This is traumatic, terrifying. But for 40-plus years, the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership, federally known as the Displaced Homemaker Program, has stepped in to help. It's been a trusted pre-employment and family stabilization program provided by a network of 6 regional partners across the state. It is the only program in the state specifically designed to help displaced homemakers address the unique barriers they face while trying to enter or re-enter the workforce under these stressful conditions. What makes this program more than a workforce development program is its holistic and client-driven approach. Participants are served through a combination of activities,
including one-to-one self-sufficiency counseling, weekly workshop series that focus on life skills, needs assessments, and the creation of individualized action plans. The program also helps participants identify and access resources that will make it possible for them to begin their journey towards self-sufficiency. You have a lot of information about the program in your handout, and now I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers to explain how this program works and talk about the program's excellent outcomes. We'll then look forward to taking your questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jean Keenan, and I'm a provider in the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership. Thank you so much for the time to testify. I drove in from rural Minnesota this morning, so I appreciate that. This wraparound program is offered at no cost to participants, all of whom are at or below 200% of the federal poverty guideline. We are very proud to say that our program is both inclusive and individualized. Some program participants are leaving same-sex relationships. Many are leaving unsafe relationships. 22% enter the program unhoused. Nearly a third of our participants identify as a race or ethnicity other than white. Each individual works with a provider to develop a unique action plan. We help participants to develop the essential transferable skills and effective job search that they will need. Additionally, we provide direct support dollars to help participants overcome barriers like minor car repairs or lack of internet access that would impede their job search and their family's stability. Finally, and most importantly, the program helps families to stabilize after a crisis by providing holistic and trauma-informed care. The average length of time in the program is 40 weeks, although participants are eligible for services for up to 12 months and sometimes longer. As you can see from the bill, funding for the program is authorized by statute and administered through deed from a small amount of the fees collected from marriage and divorce filings. This structure was specifically designed for this program alone. The amount collected from these fees was the program's sole funding source from 1982 to 1992. There was a brief period during which the program was also funded through workforce development or general fund dollars. However, in 2003, it was recommended we return to the use of these fees as our sole funding source once again. This continues to the present. The amount allocated to the program has not been increased at any time in the program's long history. As you can imagine, the cost of providing services in 2023 and beyond is very different from how it looked in the early 2000s. I heard it said earlier that we really want to work with programs that offer a hand up rather than a handout, and that is precisely what this program does. We had hoped to have you hear from one of our past program participants today, Stacy Gordon. Unfortunately, she could not appear in person as she has her family's only vehicle. Stacy is from the White Earth Tribe and is the mother of four and grandmother of five. She has given me permission to share her story as follows. Reading. I had been in an unsafe relationship and knew that for my safety and the safety of my children, I had to move to Brainerd. Not knowing anyone except for a few family members in the area, I did not have any support and felt lost. I was now a single mother of four children and was desperate to provide for my family and create stability in our lives. I found out about the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership and enrolled. From the first moment that I met with the director, I was showered with love, hope, and support, something that had been lacking in my life. I was provided a supportive environment for me to pursue my education and career goals. I attended and benefited from the various workshops and support groups. The different activities and things we learned and discussed, such as grief support, self-esteem, goal setting, resume writing, job interviewing skills and practice, communication skills, and the use of the computer lab were extremely helpful. The lab was a quiet space I could go to work on homework and job search as I did not have a computer at home. Having four kids at home made it exceedingly difficult to get anything done there. Because I lacked confidence and support, I felt like I did not belong in college. This program helped me to assimilate into the world of academia at Central Lakes College. One of the biggest goals that this program helped me accomplish was getting my driver's license. I had a lot of fear and anxiety about driving. This had always been a huge issue for me. My kids and I walked everywhere we went, rain or shine. And though we did what we had to, walking in the cold and such, it was simply very hard. I had little to no experience driving. The program director gave me the gentle nudge and support to take that step and finally take my road test. With the support and newly found confidence in myself, I passed my test. I'm now a confident, independent driver. We no longer have to walk, take a bus or cab, or bother anyone for a ride. It is a huge freedom. I had no idea how big of an impact it would make on my family. Another major goal accomplished with the help of this program was getting a car. They were very instrumental in helping me apply for a grant for a donated car from another organization. I was so happy to be the chosen recipient of a very nice car, which was and is in still very in very good condition. I couldn't have been or be any more grateful. I can now happily say that I'm a college graduate, and I'm gainfully employed in a career that I love, where I can help and support others to reach their goals as well. I'm so grateful for the services that this program has provided and for all the support I was given. The Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership has helped me in so many ways. It has changed the course of my family forever. Thank you again for your time and consideration of House File 420.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on House File 420? All right, not seeing any. Any member discussion to this bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you for the work that you do, Ms. Keenan. And how long have you been with the program?
I have been with the program. Actually, I'm going on 21 years.
That's dedication. That's dedication. So thank you for the work that you do and helping these folks kind of get back on their feet and deal with life, right? That's basically what you're doing. So thank you for the work you do.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
All right. Any further member discussion? You guys are ready to get out of here? Representative Ryer, any closing comments?
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much for your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 420 be re-referred to the Workforce Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. All right. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you, members. With that, we are adjourned.